Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Clean Energy View Radio Show. Our podcasts are available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.cleanenergyview.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, or contact me directly at June Stoyer on Twitter. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at info@cleanenergyview.com. Today, my guest is Dr. Stephen Golden, and we're going to be talking about his company, Clean Diesel Technologies, and what they're doing to combat climate change by reducing emissions. It's very interesting. Until our energy is completely sustainable, we must conserve energy and do as much as possible to reduce the impact of fossil fuels. While there are many government-type incentives to scrap the metal from different vehicles, such as the Cash for Clunkers campaign, there is still a huge dependency upon older model vehicles, especially in agriculture and construction. So on today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Stephen J. Golden, who is one of the founders of Clean Diesel Technologies. And they have really made some breakthrough technologies which are offering solutions to significantly reduce for the principal harmful emissions formed by the combustion of fossil fuels and biofuels. So I would like to welcome to the show Dr. Stephen Golden. Good afternoon, sir, and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Golden, can you please tell our audience about yourself?
Sure. So I was born in England in 1961, one of eight children, and somewhat of an interesting upbringing. Being in London, if you're from a big family, it meant you have certain, a lot of Irish and Italian families in the local parish, and my parents actually converted to be Catholic, so I should sort of thank my existence for their conversion and having a big family and really growing up in that very sort of competitive but very warm environment, and maybe it led to certain of that sort of competition and that drive when you're living in a house with sort of, I think at one point there were seven of us in the house and sort of sharing toys and sharing clothes. It was an interesting experience. And really coming out of that, as I was lucky to be in that warm community of sort of brothers and sisters and friends in an area just north of London. And really my father had a sort of huge impact on my early education, leading to what I studied at university. I think some point when I was about 14, I think he realized that I was not really doing quite as much homework as I needed. He was a scientist by training. He was a chemist, and he was great. He spent so much time with me each evening, and I have much to thank him for, to kind of drag me through the sort of end of school there in England and really plant some seeds that I'll talk about later in terms of a future direction in terms of the academic career, but it's a very interesting upbringing in a very large family.
Now, did you grow up at a farm?
No, we didn't, actually. But out in the country near where we lived, there are a lot of farm communities, and so we're always close to the countryside, and Sunday afternoon was spent walking out in the fields and sort of taking a picnic with the family, so we were very close to that environment and that farming community just on the edge of London.
It's really interesting when you grow up in that type of environment that I think you have a true appreciation of agriculture and what it takes to operate a farm and just do the things that people do in the countryside. And, you know, there's that sense of community and there's that sense of innovation, if you will, and also a very true sense of what sustainability means. And I think that it's very interesting that you kind of have a similar upbringing to me. And when you have those those fundamental elements that are instilled in you as a child, it really does lend itself to you throughout your entire life, as it has clearly done with your work, especially with CDTI.
Yeah, that's right. And I think sort of being so close to the countryside, you're part of that cycle of nature and the four seasons as well, growing up. And it's a big contrast to being as a white in London. You could literally get on a local train and be in the center of London, a huge city, in about 20 minutes. So there's that contrast, really, and the massive traffic and the pollution and the cars, and then being out in the countryside, a very stark contrast. And so growing up in that boundary between the country and the city, and seeing both worlds together was really interesting. But, being a teenager growing up on the edge of town, as it were, we were drawn, to get down to the city to really sort of enjoy the benefits, but feel the sheer weight of traffic and the noise and pollution. It was always amazing to come out of that, back into the leafy lanes, back to the countryside. What's interesting to me as I was growing up, I actually had no idea that I'd become really interested in this whole field in terms of emission control and really looking at what is a pressing issue. And people talk about the long term, which is so important in terms of other forms of energy, other ways to drive cars and trucks and buses. And that's so important to have, I think, that long-term view. But really, there's so much pressing work to be done in the short term. But again, it's interesting how I got to really look at that and think you can do something about it. And really, it came from when I went to university, first doing a bachelor's degree, then a PhD, in really studying different kinds of materials at a nano scale. And then really, it was only much later that one was starting to apply that to real devices and real solutions to try and control emissions. But just experiencing that traffic and that big city experience, it was hard to imagine that maybe 20 years later, actually, I'd be helping to put devices and have people clean up trucks and buses in that same city. But it was a long cycle, a long pathway to come a background to London, three or four years ago from when I was growing up there. So it's kind of a long story. But really, back to my dad, I mean, he was such a he was so strong in terms of pushing me to a scientific career. I was really, really fortunate in terms of having his background to really help me choose a good university. And that's always a big saga in England when you're finishing that final year of school, in terms of where you go, what you study. And I had a good fortune to go to a university in north of England called Sheffield University. And it felt a long way from London culturally, very warm people, very friendly. A city based on steel, going way back, of course, and now moving out of that industry to other industries and other sources of jobs. But for me, it was a great experience because it was really studying these fundamental materials and the surfaces of materials that was really part of the building block for me, that then later I felt to apply to the kinds of materials you need to make and develop to really convert these harmful emissions. But it was really step by step. And that 3 years in that very bustling city, but very warm city with very friendly people, and having a chance to study these fundamental materials and how you make materials. And I think the big emphasis in the UK in that whole discipline of making new materials was interesting, because they really stressed the value of that invention. So it was quite academic, of course, but it also had a very real and applied side to it, in terms of, well, what's the business case and how will you really apply that and to bring that new material to the marketplace. And so for me, it was a very early look at not just the material science and these new materials that were going to be applied to different industries, but also the thinking, actually, that you're not just a scientist developing new stuff, you're also thinking about the business. Can you make it cost effectively? Is there a market for that material? And so it was a very interesting first exposure on the business side, which actually became very important. You know, starting your own business eventually, that business feel for what's going to work, and maybe without the full-blown education of a business degree or these advanced degrees, nevertheless having that sense of what's going to work in the marketplace, we came back through. So really, you know, from that early look at material science, I eventually, after several years, came back to a PhD program, which was in London at Imperial College, which is really a specialised science and technology college in London, and I had the good fortune to work for Brian Steele, and my thesis there was really picking up on some of the fundamental materials work I did at Sheffield, but really focusing, of course, on a very specific problem. And that problem for my thesis was really linked to how you can control light and radiation coming through a window. So I was making a smart window, which was an interesting field, because actually a sunlight coming into a room during a hot day builds up a huge amount of heat in the room, which then you need to air condition and use energy to cool down. So if you can have a smart window that blocks some of that low wavelength energy coming in, you can actually cut down air conditioning. So it was a very applied thesis, but it was a lot of fundamental material science again, building out what I did at Sheffield. And the big sort of leap from that, if you will, really across thousands of miles to California, was really, you know, the final year of spinning the globe, and it was a very important occupation for people in their third year of a PhD program in the UK, which is really the final year. And so you're thinking about, well, what do I do next year? Where should I go? And it's that feeling of freedom, hoping you get through the program and get your PhD, of really being able to choose where you go and have some choices. So I ended up in California. I had a friend that passed through the West Coast, and he went to a UCLA, a UC Santa Barbara, different campuses. And then he said, Steve, if you get a chance and the job at a UCSB, at Santa Barbara, you should grab it. It's a wonderful place. And he described this sort of beautiful seaside town. I had the good fortune to get a job at UCSB, and that was that really good fortune of the network between my supervisor at Imperial College and Fred Lang, who worked at UCSB. So that was really the link. September the 12th, 1988, saw me with a small red suitcase take the trip from London to L.A., and a small flight up to Santa Barbara, and I was sort of in the airport, just sort of getting my suitcase, and there was no one else there except this a wonderful guy, Fred Lang, waiting for me. You know, the airport had thinned out; we hadn't met before, and so we assumed that we were supposed to be meeting, and that was the start of a job at a UCSB, which was really focused on much more applied ways of making different types of material science. Again, I hadn't really even moved to the emissions field yet. This was, again, more knowledge this time in terms of how to fabricate materials with these high surface areas, with these unique structures. And a very different environment from London. And, you know, sunny every day, even in the winter time. It's an amazing place to land. I was very, very fortunate to be there, and I still live there at the moment. So it's hard to escape that place, certainly.
You know, it's just interesting when you look at somebody's journey and you look at the different things that they've done in their life, their education, their upbringing, so on and so forth, how they've come to where they're at and to doing or just being such a big part of an effort that affects not only you as an individual, but, you know, the things that you've done affect everyone. And what I find interesting is that when it comes to reducing energy consumption or reducing the impact of fossil fuels, there should be no reason why it can't be a lucrative business opportunity. I mean, people tend to just focus on the fact that fossil fuels have been a very big moneymaker. But the thing is that when we look at these other elements, these are also very big lucrative areas for business. An area that I focus on quite a bit is recycling and composting. I think it's a tremendous opportunity. I mean, even with rare earth metals, the recycling of rare earth metals is a tremendous opportunity to make money, but it's something that, unfortunately, in the United States, we haven't quite gotten that point across, and I think that's something that we will at some point. But when it comes to... With your work, I think
it's so fascinating. I mean, I think so. Even in the case of water, I mean, just to pull up your example, you know, in the UK they have the water treatment works that sort of really recycle water all the way through back to high quality drinking water. And it was amazing to me, being in Santa Barbara, that it's basically a one way, you know, the lake in the mountains, and we use the water, and then it all goes into the ocean more or less in a kind of one way traffic. And even something as basic as water recycling that's been around since the 1800s, you know, is not a mainstream thing in America. It's used in some cities, but those old familiar technologies of recycling to be used fully, it would have a huge impact on the water usage, for example. Yes, so it's fascinating what's just lying in front of us. And it doesn't sound so glamorous as inventing something completely new, but it's really adapting something that's right there to have a huge impact on society. And really, that was the theme. And eventually left UCSB and sort of did a work for a startup company locally. We were working on battery technology. But the experience really for me in that startup was my business experience of how to try and sort of start a new company and sort of to help to manage a small company that's sort of growing and working with investors and working on the business plan. But really coming out of that was that confidence I had, and very fortunate to work for 2 years in that environment to build certain skill sets without going to university to study them, but to really practice them in a real environment in a small company was really interesting for me. And that connection really was the birth of the company that I founded, to really then specialize in these sort of new materials that I've been more or less studying for 15 years or so, and really trying to apply them to this other field. And it's that connection of things that are close at hand together, which is so important in starting a new company. It's not always as glamorous as some completely new application. It's really saying, well, what if we can clean the emissions from cars and trucks and buses much more efficiently with this new material? So when I started the company, there's already a fairly big industry of people making these types of devices, converters and filters and different ways to control emissions from a car or truck. The thing I was trying to do was to say, well, let's do it more efficiently. Let's do it using much less of the precious metals. So therefore, that technology can be much more available to the world as a whole, as you make the fundamental material science be the key feature, not the use of precious metals. And that was really the back of the envelope almost, but it was a sense of confidence of that connection of one thing and the other, the material science background, with what seemed to be a big opportunity. That was really the birth of the company, although it sounds extremely simple. But I think it had to be. You know, you have to have that simple connection. And then the key thing about how we work as a human being is that belief system and that drive behind that connection that really has to drive you through lots of obstacles and to lots of frustrations in the years ahead. But you keep hold of that faith and that premise, if you like, which seems very simplistic, but you do have to have that belief system through what you're trying to do, even though you bump into obstacles that really make you question whether it's the right thing. But you keep on going somehow. So that's really stubbornness or something.
I think one of the things that I find to be interesting, especially in the business world, is they say in sales, when you're trying to acquire new customers, it's less expensive and it requires less energy and effort if you just keep the existing customer happy, and it takes twice the amount of energy, effort, time, so on and so forth, to acquire new customers. So if you take that mentality and then apply it to energy, if we have energy that we're using and until we can become completely sustainable and self-sufficient as far as renewables, why can't we just use what we have and reduce the impact as much as possible until we're at that point? That would require a lot less as we're doing things simultaneously. And it's unfortunate that people don't find it as glamorous, because I personally like I like good quality air, good quality water, as well as soil. And I think the work that you're doing is helping to protect the air, the environment as a whole. And I think that that is something that is doable, especially in real time. And this is the type of innovation that we need. I remember just growing up as a kid, just thinking about the school buses, just how awful those fumes were.
Yeah.
And if you think about that, I remember that there was a very big, just a very big push throughout the 80s in regards to the emissions. And the thing is that when you think about these things, people talk about them and they may complain about them, or they just may not give it much thought other than, well, it's not my problem, let somebody else deal with it. But the fact that you've been able to create technologies that can actually address this, and it's not just one particular area, with the technology that you've developed, exactly how many areas can the technologies be used? And can you also talk about the four principal issues that they address?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's interesting how a company evolves, and it really evolved into these different areas as we grew in knowledge and as a product development. And it really started out working with Honda Motor Company, who really I targeted from the beginning as a very sort of go-ahead company with a real sort of technology appreciation, actually trying very hard to clean their vehicles and make very clean engines and make sure they used really good control systems to try and minimize the emissions from the tailpipe. So it was a very exciting company to try and work with and try and convince, actually, that we had something unique. And really, the big appeal for them was we had an offering, we had a product for their cars that was going to use much less precious metal, which meant they could, in effect, make them more high performance. So there's always a trade-off between price and performance to some extent. And so the fact that we could make the fundamental coatings more efficient could really extend their use and really help this customer, Honda, to make much more efficient vehicles. Well, of course, they were pushing the boundary in terms of engine technology, but they were looking for a partner on the after-treatment side to really go with the engine development, and so we've really benefited from that close relationship, and then that relationship extended to other car makers, GM and Ford and so forth. So that was a huge early market for us, and it's still very important. As we see sort of tighter emission standards globally in the area of passenger cars, we're really in that strong position in terms of technology, but really looking for ways to extend the reach of that product because of its efficiency, because of the fundamental materials, versus the use of very precious metals, which is too easy in a way, but has a price. And if you look at what's happening in sort of different mining countries throughout the world, and the pressure to mine these precious metals, you can really get a sense of that of that regime and how moving from the use of expensive metals to really nanotechnology and more smart technology, you can really try and transform an industry. And I think it's fair to say, as a small company, we had a big impact on the auto industry in terms of the catalyst to clean emissions, because we were starting to make sure that the big companies were also now looking at technology. So we had this sort of double effect of our sales, which was a benefit for those vehicles our product went on, of course, but also the leverage effect on our big competitors to focus more on technology. So we're moving out of that. It was really moving into diesel. And it's funny, coming from the UK and knowing people in different countries in Europe, just what a bad reputation diesel had in the past. And so Germany is really a prime example where diesel was smelly, disgusting, slow, noisy. And what was interesting in the through use of very clean engine technology, sort of common rail injection and all these types of technologies, they really sort of transformed from a country that really didn't want diesel at all to now really embracing the technology. And it's really important because you look at these kinds of interim solutions and you look at different kinds of engine technology, and the kind of technology where you burn diesel fuel is so much more efficient from energy efficiency, from a CO2 standpoint. The big problem was with it was all these other emissions, and we can talk about a sort of global warming, but fundamentally, if you're reducing the fuel used, but you're still pumping out soot particles and NOx emissions from these diesel engines, that's no real benefit because you're really making lots of short-term health issues for people on the ground. So really the place where we work on diesel is to try and bring that same efficiency of the material science that we developed for gasoline into the diesel world, so that as people were looking to unveil more and more diesel cars and trucks and buses, which are far more efficient than the natural gas or gasoline versions, we could also make sure that the emissions from the tailpipe are going to be low, so people stay healthy and we can reduce the emissions in these urban areas. And really the big one that you can see and smell so clearly behind the bus without a filter is the soot particles. And it's more and more studies are coming out in terms of the very bad effects in terms of deep lung tissue and so forth of these more soot particles. And yet there was always a solution there which involved a filter to trap the soot particles and then the catalyst to combust them, so you could have a clean filter and no soot coming out of the tailpipe. And really moving from the gasoline passenger car side, which I described, to now looking at different markets for diesel products was really exciting. And really, we made an acquisition of a company in 2007 called Engine Control Systems, based in Canada. And they were a specialist company making filter systems for bus and truck markets, mostly in the U.S. And that was a great acquisition, a great partnership we built there between the catalyst technology that we had from the beginning, now really added to the really good engineering know-how of a system company. So now we could really bring that technology to the market much more easily. And we're doing a lot of school bus programs in California, which we're very proud of. And really that company was one of the forerunners of pushing the use of filters on different diesel machines and different diesel vehicles to have this huge impact on the local air quality. So while we're looking at people look at the global warming issue and the importance of diesel because it's much more fuel efficient, you have to have these kinds of systems on these cars and trucks with diesel technology to make sure they're healthy, you know, make sure the tailpipe is healthy and not going to pollute the city. So really, what we were developing and have developed and to continue to develop is really technologies that really enable diesel to be rolled out much, much more fully with our impact on the global situation, but also looking at local air quality, which is a key concern for electronic combustion. So we made a shift really from just making the technology for the passenger cars and really extending up that technology to a whole new reach, a whole new sector in terms of diesel, which is really exciting.
Now, with the older models, how does the technology work? Because I know that...
I mean, it's a great question because, you know, it's quite easy to... I mean, look at new vehicles, new trucks, new buses. I mean, everything is so smart and intelligent, the way it's designed, state-of-the-art technology. And the catalyst and the filters really designed in those new vehicles. So I think the challenge that we've been taking head on and other companies in our space is saying, well, what about the vehicles already on the street? What about the fleets that are already out there? These very high emissions of soot particles, you know, we need to do something about that. So it's been very exciting to be part of the retrofit markets where we're going back to these older buses and trucks, sometimes 15, 20 years old even, with these really robust solutions with our material science technology to really are able to control those emissions, and it's a different world than the brand new vehicle working with a.
Oh, of course.
Working in OEM, you have all kinds of very practical engineering problems, and the skill of the team we have is in, you know, being able to do that retrofit quickly and efficiently, so that the fleet owner with his trucks or buses can have that vehicle come in and come out and be retrofitted very quickly to have a quick impact with a minimum impact, just a negative impact on the owner's business. So that's really where we've done very well, and looking to extend that argument to other cities, to other parts of the world, which are really, in a way, stuck with bad air quality. Because, okay, you have these devices on new vehicles, and that's going to have a long-term impact, sure. But what about the next 10, 15 years? You've still got these dirty fleets, the dirty buses, these very high-polluting vehicles. And so I think it's excellent that cities are moving in that direction, and it's important that these very robust technologies that are cost-effective out there to really help them meet their local targets.
Especially with, for example, with agriculture. I mean, in agriculture, you have many small farms that just can't afford the brand new modern equipment that, you know, has the electric motors that are cleaner, and also the fact that to a certain degree you're preventing a lot of these vehicles from winding up in the junkyard, because in essence you're kind of giving them a second wind so that they can still be used. And you know, let's face it, they don't make these vehicles the way that they used to. And some of these older model vehicles,
right,
they were really, really built to last, and especially with the farm equipment. And it's interesting when you look at people that are starting farms, that are trying to, I guess, live the charm life of in the world of farming, which, you know, it's a lot of work, but they're doing this as best as they can, and often they will have the opportunity to utilize equipment that maybe one of their neighboring farmers has no need for, or they'll buy it at an auction, whatever the case may be. And if they can use it and make modifications to the vehicle so that the emissions have been reduced and, you know, it's still a very efficient vehicle, then why not? I mean, why not utilize something that we have instead of just, you know, sending it off to the landfill?
That's right, and I think looking at the price of new vehicles, you know, and especially in this current climate economically, it's a tough one for the smaller farmer to look at just these very expensive vehicles with the emission controls on them. But it's a tough call these days. So people are making do much more with their older vehicles and seeing how they can keep them going. But I think to get a robust solution to clean those emissions on these older off-road agricultural vehicles is going to be a challenge, but certainly there that people need to meet. We need to meet to really not just look at the on-road sector, but in lots of off-road sectors, marine, agriculture, gensets, rail is going to be coming in. All these off-road sectors are going to need very good technology, very sort of flexible solutions to really be able to lower the emissions from these kinds of off-road diesels, which includes agriculture as well. I think that's a challenge. It's really always.
You mentioned marine, and that wasn't even something that I had considered. And that's, you know, that's very important. I mean, you don't really think about that unless you are directly involved in an industry where there are different boats and other equipment that are used by the ocean or in the ocean.
That's right, and they're talking about how to limit the, you know, the emissions from boats as they come near shore into port, and that's the first place to look. But really, the ocean-going ships, you know, is a huge source of pollution, and often using very low-quality fuel, which makes the job even harder to clean the emissions. So there's a huge amount of off-road opportunities, marine being one of those sectors, agriculture being a very big one too, that, you know, people move beyond the on-road world, certainly in North America, Europe, and other sort of developed countries, I think the argument moves to the off-road and all these different sectors. And it's a much more complicated set of problems to meet because of the size. If you think about a large marine application, the size of a catalyst or the filter needed there is just, you know, sort of vastly different scale to what goes on to a big truck even. So they have to use the imagination and the skill set to make the systems and the competency and the know-how has to be developed pretty quickly for these big machines as well. So that's going to be, I think, the next 5 to 10 years is going to be a big challenge. But fundamental material science and the know-how is there, but how to scale up some of these technologies, I think. And it really links to this other concern, which we have very good fuel quality in North America, in the U.S., and it's true in Europe, but I took the sulfur out of diesel, and I'll explain just a few minutes why that's important. So sulfur occurs naturally in sort of crude oil, and when you make diesel fuel, typically the sulfur content is still relatively high as a pass-through from the crude oil. And if you don't remove it, what happens is that sulfur tends to make the cleanup and these filters get plugged, basically. So it's very hard to clean the emissions from a diesel engine running on high sulfur diesel, which was really what was everywhere in the world until they started removing it in the U.S. over the last 15, 20 years, and the same in Europe. But if you look at the so-called emerging markets, for example, in Brazil, India, China, you've got huge parts of those countries with very high sulfur diesel still, very, very bad quality fuel. And there's a sense of, I think, which people are waiting for something to happen and it's not happening, which is, you know, the massive investment that needs to be made to basically remove the sulfur from the fuel, which has happened in North America, which has happened in Europe, happened in Japan, for example. It's a very, very big investment, and it took Europe 5 to 10 years to get from where it was to very low sulfur diesel, which now means you can use all these cleanup devices and filters. I think one of the big other challenges, if you move from off-road back to on-road, but now very high sulfur fuel, very, very poor fuel quality, is we develop